Coming up, is it ethical for terminally ill patients to end their lives? Also, Lucky Severson on the growing number of benefit corporations, B Corps. They're for-profit companies with social goals they say are as important as maximizing profit. And Bob Thaw on a white writer who listens to Native Americans and says their spirituality helps him overcome the guilt he feels for the country's treatment of its original inhabitants.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week at the Vatican, Pope Francis again urged prayers for Ebola victims and called on the international community to do everything possible to eradicate the virus. The World Health Organization said the rate of new cases may be slowing in Liberia, the worst-hit country, but that the fight was far from over. During a visit to West Africa, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power said a much greater international response is needed to defeat Ebola. A delegation of top Yazidi religious leaders came to the U.S. this week seeking help for their besieged community in Iraq. ISIS has particularly targeted the ancient religious minority, which ISIS calls pagan. More than 300,000 Yazidis have been displaced and now need humanitarian aid. The delegation says it has documented the names of nearly 7,000 girls and young women who've been kidnapped by ISIS and forced into sexual slavery. The group met with religious and political leaders and urged the international community to do more to stop what it called the extermination of Yazidis.
We knew there were hatred against us, but we did not know that it would be to this extent that people will see us not as human beings.
ISIS believes that the Yazidis should no longer exist within what they call Muslim lands, that God will hold Muslims accountable for allowing the Yazidis to have remained in the Middle East for this long.
This week, the group Human Rights Watch issued a new report documenting kidnappings, forced marriages, and sexual abuse of girls and young women in Nigeria by the Islamist group Boko Haram. The report says more than 500 women have been abducted there in recent years, including the 270 schoolgirls kidnapped in April. The Catholic Archdiocese of New York plans to merge 14% of its parishes with others, according to Cardinal Timothy Dolan. In a newspaper column, the New York Archbishop said it was not feasible to keep so many parishes open because of the dwindling numbers of Catholics and priests. Meanwhile, the Archdiocese of Chicago, citing budget deficits, announced this week that it would close or merge 14 elementary schools at the end of the academic year. Earlier this year, in April, 29-year-old Brittany Maynard was given 6 months to live after being diagnosed with advanced brain cancer. She made headlines when she pledged to end her life with the help of a doctor rather than continue to suffer. Maynard's announcement has generated much debate, including criticism from some religious groups. Joining me to talk about the ethical issues surrounding the case is Kathy Lynn Grossman, senior national correspondent for Religion News Service, who's been writing about death and dying for many years. Kathy, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Bob.
How do we all divide on this?
Americans divide fairly sharply on this issue. It depends on their value system. If their values are primarily based on what they believe in, the personal choices that they want to make, personal control over things, a secular value system, versus people who make their decisions based on religious choices, that God alone decides the day of your death.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty evenly divided.
It is. Research has shown.
What's the difference between what we're talking about here and euthanasia?
There's a very sharp difference. Euthanasia is deliberately killing somebody else, with or without their consent. whereas this is physician-assisted dying. In the five states where it's legal, someone following very rigorous regulations, how long they live there. Brittany Maynard moved from California to Oregon, where it's legal, specifically to qualify for this, are given a prescription for lethal drugs. The person takes the drugs themselves, if and when they choose to, and not everyone who gets the prescription ever uses it.
Hmm. And what about the family, the other people involved in this? It must be terribly difficult.
It's terribly difficult when somebody is dying, and the best thing you can do for the people that you love is to have advance directives. Talk with the people who care about you and tell them what your wishes are for how you would like to be cared about when your days are nearing an end, and spell it out in writing. Make sure they have a copy. Choose someone who can speak for you when you can't speak for yourself.
And do families typically all agree on this or not?
No, they don't, which is why it's really important to have these conversations. There are many resources that you can find online or by mail that will help you talk about this, or talk with your doctor, talk with your clergyman to help work this out.
And name somebody very specifically
somebody.
Who you want to have the decision made.
You do not want to open your eyes in a hospital bed and have your physicians, your children, and your ethicist arguing about your care.
Kathy Lynn Grossman of Religion News Service, many thanks.
Thank you.
We have a Lucky Severson story today about the growing number of benefit corporations, or B Corps. They're for-profit companies that think their service to their workers and communities is as valuable as maximizing profit. And they insist that in the long run, those twin missions are good for their shareholders.
This is a company called United by Blue. For every product they sell, they promise to remove a pound of trash from oceans and waterways. And they don't just send a check. They host cleanups across the country. It's one of over 1,000 businesses in the U.S. now designated as a benefit corporation, or B Corp.
They're doing it because they are guided by a sense of whether they call them values or ethics or spirituality or religion, whatever it might be, that's their center of gravity that says even when no one's looking and even if nobody else cares, I care, and this is how I want to behave.
Jay Cohn Gilbert is one of three Stanford University schoolmates who did extremely well in business and then co-founded the B Corp movement. In 2006, they started a nonprofit organization called B Lab, dedicated to using the power of for-profit businesses to solve social and environmental problems. An increasing number of states have approved new legislation promoted by B Lab, making it easier for companies to commit to higher standards of purpose and accountability.
The idea is to change the conversation from you and I supporting just a good product to you and I supporting a good company.
Bart Houlihan and Andrew Kasoy are B Corp co-founders.
Lots of this can feel really good, and you can have lots of people who want to live in a different economy, but the rules of the old economy are an impediment often. We have to do things like change laws so that it's clear that investors can choose to invest in these kinds of businesses and create long-term value without being worried about getting sued by a short-term investor who wants them to think about nothing other than how much money they make this quarter.
Through a stringent set of standards, B Lab also measures a company's real impact on its workers, the community, and the environment. In other words, they certify that the company is doing the good it promises to do.
Yeah. Have you had any corporations that have lost their certification?
You bet. We're a pretty pragmatic culture here in the U.S. We pretty much want to see performance, not just a good mission statement on the wall. And that's where things like a B Corp certification matter, because it shows that folks are actually walking their talk.
The King Arthur Flour Company is the oldest flour company in America, over 200 years old, employee-owned, and a B Corp. Their campus in Norwich, Vermont, includes a warehouse and an on-site bakery. Suzanne McDowell is a co-CEO and vice president of human resources.
It's an opportunity for us to not just think about the bottom line, which, you know, is important, But there are other things that are as important: the environment, the, you know, our society, our community, all of our shareholders, all of our stakeholders, not just the bottom line.
King Arthur pays its employees well, offers health insurance for part-timers, and gives its workers a week off each year to do community service. Jay Rimmel, a production manager, says it's caused employees to think more about giving.
There's a local haven, homeless shelter. We've volunteered there. There's a food shelf locally that a lot of us have volunteered for. So we have some people that do reading for school kids. I think it's trickled down and actually pulled some people into doing volunteer that they wouldn't normally have thought of.
Martin Phillip is in charge of the bakery. A self-titled breadhead, he came to King Arthur from the world of investment banking. Now he's proud to work for a company that cares about more than the bottom line.
It means that we're looking at who we are within a community.
Yeah.
It means that we're looking at who we are within the environment. So how are we taking care of our environment? What are the resources that we're using? How could we do better?
You know, we want to increase our assessment on the environmental side. And so we decided to put in these electric vehicle charging stations, which we are one of 70 in the state of Vermont.
There are critics of the B Corp model. A common concern is that the very existence of B Corp implies that there is something missing or lacking in conventional companies.
We hear that all the time, and we're not here to stand against anything. We're here to stand for something. It's not about tearing anybody down. It's about highlighting the leaders and showing people that there's a better way to do business, and then everybody else can follow.
Kenneth Goodpaster is a professor of business ethics emeritus at the University of St. Thomas. He helped draft a groundbreaking Vatican document released in 2012 entitled The Vocation of the Business Leader. It says business leadership is a noble calling and an opportunity to practice Catholic social teaching, which underscores human dignity and the common good.
Good goods, good work, and good wealth are the three pillars of this vocation of the business leader, and all three of those principles are to be found in the business corp idea.
But Professor Goodpaster says there are still lurking problems with the B Corp seal of approval.
Unscrupulous managers who would, in the name of doing good, abuse the capital that was given to them and make excuses because we didn't get a good return this year because we were busy doing what we had to do in the social sense, when in fact it was mismanagement that led to the poor returns in that year. And there need to be safeguards for the shareholders.
Corporate law generally favors the shareholders who invest to make a profit. Bart Houlihan learned that firsthand before he co-founded B Corp when he sold his $250 million basketball footwear and apparel company.
The moment when we sold the company, by law, the only thing that we could consider at that time was maximizing shareholder value. And it felt to me at the back end of that there had to be a better way.
One of the more famous examples of a company's fiduciary obligations to the shareholders occurred in the year 2000 when Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, the famous do-gooder company, was suddenly purchased by a European conglomerate. The founders were accused of selling out, but their lawyer said if they didn't sell, because the offer was above market price, they could be sued by the shareholders. With a B Corp designation, that would be far less likely to happen.
Welcome to Ben & Jerry's. I'm going to be your tour guide today, so I'll take you on the three-part tour of our factory, where you'll see a quick video about how the company got started.
As it turned out, Ben & Jerry's was allowed by its new owner to continue its social mission and is now a certified money-making B Corp. It's that bottom line that causes some to question the real value of B Corporations. Can they compete at the bottom line?
We know that B Corps have gone out of business at a lower rate than companies like them in the rest of the economy.
Not only did they survive, and not only were they creating jobs, over 53% of B Corps during that period actually had 5% job growth during the same five-year period where private industry in the U.S. shed 7 million jobs.
There have been over 40 studies done about B Corporations like King Arthur Flour, comparing them to conventional companies.
All of whom have concluded that Stronger environmental, social, and governance performance leads to long-term value creation for shareholders. Period. Full stop.
The timing may be ripe for companies pushing for more than just financial profit.
There's some interesting data that's come out recently about millennials, who now represent, I believe, over 50% of the workforce, and that they're looking for something more than just money in their work.
Students of today, at least the ones we see in our classrooms, want that larger meaning. It's not that they're totally selfless or that they're only altruists, but sure, they want jobs and they want to have families and communities and resources, but that's not enough for them these days. And I don't know if it ever was enough, but at least they're more explicit these days about how important that is to them.
As they sail away on Lake Champlain for their annual retreat, B Corps CEOs feel they're getting the wind at their back. B-Lab now certifies companies in 34 countries, and over half the states have approved the benefit corporation legislation. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Burlington, Vermont.
Kent Nerburn is an author whose specialty is listening to the stories of Native Americans, their spirituality, their reverence for nature. For Nerburn, what he's learned by listening has brought him a sense of personal forgiveness for the country's treatment of Native Americans. Bob Faw spoke with him.
Way-ya, hey-ya, 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 oh, way-yo.
In the backyard of their Minneapolis home, Native Americans Jackie and Kirk Crowshoe perform what they call a healing song. For many, what Native American rituals and ceremonies mean, what Indians believe and why, has seemed a mystery. But in these books, it is expertly revealed and explained by this rumpled 68-year-old white man, award-winning writer and spiritual teacher, Kent Nerburn.
My job was to watch, to record, and to serve in some capacity, to do what you have to do to make them open their hearts and to get the stories out that they want to tell.
Calling himself a guerrilla theologian who tries to find the spiritual in everything, Nerburn has spent a career writing about Native American people. In this trilogy, he uses actual dialogues he's had with Native Americans, which are then spoken by fictional characters in what Nerburn calls spiritual storytelling.
My goal is to be present to their emotional reality and put it in people who, in the voices and in the characters of people that are real people, and that try to make it so it speaks from honest emotions.
Nerburn says he felt an obligation because of what happened in this country to the Native Americans. It was nothing less than cultural genocide, he told parishioners at St. Joan of Arc Catholic Church in Minneapolis.
But these are an occupied people who are marked for extermination by relocation, starvation, military slaughter, and finally by re-education that ripped the heart out of the traditional ways.
What Native Americans suffered troubled Kent Nerburn as well, and inspired his writing.
To earn forgiveness for the shame in my blood. Shame in my blood. That's you talking.
That was me talking. And I wanted to get forgiveness for the crimes of my culture. I feel like I carry the crimes of my fathers. And how do I make it right?
So Nerburn began to explore and listen to Native Americans like Jackie Crowshoe and her husband Kirk, who initially was very skeptical about what this white outsider wanted.
You know, my folks, having been in the boarding schools, and when the boarding schools shut down, my generation being adopted out into non-Indian homes, the abuses I experienced in that non-Indian home, coming to terms with all of that, I had little faith in or trust in particularly white men. And so, of course, I'm going to think that he's only looking for some way to exploit us, exploit our culture for his own purposes.
What made Native Americans like the Crowshoes open up and eventually trust Kent Nerburn is that this white outsider really did listen.
He listened. And what I mean by that is he intently heard me. There was something about his spirit when I talked to him that was very gentle, authentic.
I think Kent is, he is such a remarkable man, but I think it's because of his, you know, his study, his theology, his he's able to come to this place because of his spirituality.
As he listened, what Kent Nerburn found was far removed from the Hollywood stereotype of bloodthirsty primitives, but who instead see everything in nature as living.
For the Native people, the land is alive. The events on the land are alive. The wind is alive. This degree of the land being alive and the land having its own spirit and its own story and its own teachings is just part and parcel of the Native way of seeing the world.
Kirk and Jackie Crowshoe explain how, for them, there is no distinction between the sacred and the everyday, and that the simplest objects, like an eagle feather, are reminders of something greater.
There's nothing special about it, and there's everything special about it.
Right.
Because of what he learned, Kent Nerburn told that Catholic congregation they and all non-Natives would do well to embrace what Native Americans believe.
We believe that what the Creator had given us was enough, and that the place he had put us was where we belonged. For us, the world was a mystery to be honored, not a puzzle to be solved.
One of his books, celebrating Native American culture, is now being made into a film. And if we begin to appreciate that culture, Kent Nerburn tells his readers, we'd be far more careful how we label Native Americans.
You named us savages, so that made us savages. You named where we lived the wilderness, so that made it a wild and dangerous place. Without even knowing it, you made us who we are in your minds by the words you used.
A one-time reporter and sculptor with a PhD in art and theology, Nerburn says he became more sensitive because Native Americans have given him a gift. As he puts it, their world and their way of seeing have enriched my world and my way of seeing.
What these books do is they speak to the common humanity of us all while trying to acknowledge the uniqueness of the cultural manifestations. I want these books to be healing books, teaching books, healing books.
Does it make my spirit happy that Kent is able to do something that many people, non-natives, can embrace and appreciate and understand and relate to, and who many natives can say, thank you, that was done very respectfully, well done. So that brings me hope, absolutely.
Ultimately, what he has learned and what he has written has brought Kent Nerburn the relief he was seeking.
You didn't cause this. But your job is to take responsibility for the knowledge and to do something with it.
Did you find a kind of forgiveness writing these three books?
Yes.
The shame in your blood was diminished.
It was diminished because I got lucky. I got to write these books. I got to know the people. I got to become the voice of the voiceless. And so that's my way through this. And in the learning, maybe you get some peace. But that's really all you can do.
For Native Americans, then, the landscape is marred with sadness and loss. But in this song of healing, as in the work of Kent Nerburn, there is also an echo of redemption and hope. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faw in Minneapolis.
Finally, on our calendar this weekend, Christians honor saints and martyrs on All Saints Day, followed by All Souls Day, when Catholics and some Protestants pray for loved ones who have died. On Wednesday, Shiite Muslims observe Ashura, which recalls the martyrdom of Muhammad's grandson, Hussein. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website, including more about the Yazidis. You can also listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican, which this week unveiled state-of-the-art lighting and air purification designed to better protect the frescoes.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.